Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this fine evening?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice again.
Oh, excellent. Well, I was reading Esquire magazine, and this is an article about the big four companies. They're dominating the tech world right now. It's Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Google. And so I'm reading this article. It's about their business practices, their tax schemes, employees, how they've managed to capture so much of the market.
Yeah.
And as I get halfway through, something in this article starts to sound really familiar. I'm going to quote this article. Consumers aren't paying $1,000 for an iPhone X because they're passionate about facial recognition. They're signaling that they make a good living, appreciate the arts, and have disposable income. It's a sign to others, if you mate with me, your kids are more likely to survive than if you mate with someone carrying an Android phone. In other words, mating with someone who's on an iOS platform is a shorter path to a better life.
There you go. Very good. Good thinking, whoever's writing that. That's clearly Jeffrey Miller-inspired thinking. Excellent.
Yeah, Dr. Lyle, I don't have an iPhone X, but I do have some sort of iPhone. I don't know which brand, but it's something my sister handed down to me. So, you know, hopefully I'll get some chips for that.
Yeah, exactly. I hear you. I would, if it wasn't for a very good friend of mine, my best friend that just leans on me and beats me over the head, I'd still have a flip phone. So that's, I thought that was cool. That was absolutely a play on the Star Trek communicator, and I didn't really want to give it up. All right.
Well, we've got a couple of questions. We got a couple of questions here about, this is kind of the personality traits of an alpha male. So, dear Dr. Lyle, I was wondering what the personality traits are in terms of the big five of a dominance hierarchy climbing alpha male. Also, would a male who's able to ascend these dominance hierarchies and a male who's in the top percentile in terms of physical attractiveness both be considered alpha males, since both would supposedly have wide access to a wide array of females? Maybe through different circumstances, or is it the ability to be dominant, the defining characteristic?
All right, I'm going to back up just a second and clarify. There's no such thing as an alpha male in human nature. So this is sort of shorthand talk for that humans have now that people have now adopted. I think this is probably, you know, a few decades old, leaking its way out of biology as we became more familiar and more comfortable. It's been the last few decades where it's been increasingly comfortable to see humans as animals and to see human even human social structures as having been derived from animal kingdom processes. So in many animals, what there is is that there's actually a quite vertical hierarchy, and every creature in that hierarchy essentially has a slot. I've been told this, and it may not be true. So I don't want to go on record as that this is truth, but it's my understanding that if you have chickens in a chicken coop, you know, and you've got 25 of them, they will find their slots. And it will be the case that number 16 will push number 23 out of the pot. 23 will yield. In other words, everybody knows every binary relationship. Somehow this is signaled. The humans are not like this. Humans' status is actually not in a hierarchy. It's a scramble competition. And so this is different, just in the same way that mating competitions in certain animals are most definitely a direct vertical hierarchy. So you're going to see this in lions, elephants, seals, things like this. There is an alpha, horses. So this is not an uncommon pattern where it's absolutely vertical. And there's a alpha male at the top. And if you want to mate and get access to the females, you're going to get access to essentially all of the females. And you are going to have to defeat all comers. This is not true in humans. Humans have a different mating strategy, and it's going to be what we call a scramble competition. Mating's happening all over the place, and there's a scrambling marketplace that is not being ruled by an alpha. Now, of course, we see in human history when males have occasionally gotten unbelievable military dominance, weaponry, etc., and got themselves organized, they did arrange themselves in vertical hierarchies, and but this is through bizarre, completely non-evolutionary means. So a Genghis Khan, who apparently is responsible for, I think his DNA is in 2% of the people on the planet right now, something like this. This guy obviously is the closest thing to an alpha that you're going to see in human nature. But anyway, so just to get clear, we use these terms and we use them in a sloppy fashion. So what we really mean when we say alpha male is we mean a dominant human, dominant personality, that is going to get more than his share of mating opportunities, and he is a customer that is difficult to deal with. So probably certainly size, strength, and disagreeableness, just sheer aggression, these are characteristics that we associate with what we would call alpha male. However, that doesn't necessarily mean who's in charge, because it all depends on the circumstances about how the rules are set up and what the group needs most. Alpha could be, you know, the skinny little guy with phenomenal mathematical abilities that's going to try to get your rocket ship home. So anyway, so we're now I'm going to try to go back and retrace some of the questions that this person is trying to ask. It sounds to me like one of the questions that they're bouncing around in their head is the issue of dominance of personality versus physical attractiveness, and which seems to be, quote, the most important. Well, it depends on for what. If you're talking about access to females, it's probably going to be, there's going to be data on two sides of this question, so I think it's a little messy, and I don't think we really quite know the answer. We've got modern data from the internet dating world that shows that physical attractiveness is unbelievably dominant. So, but this is a world where we're not getting real-time evidence of what's actually happening in other circumstances where other characteristics can be picked up. Now, so we can see that physical attractiveness is a gigantic factor in predicting how easy men find it to get mates. However, if we actually look at how many children people have, that's where it gets interesting. There's evidence to suggest that if you were to look at two different types of males, one of which is handsome in a pretty way, in other words, maybe a little softer, slightly effeminate, but very, quote, cute. You look at that versus males who are not cute and don't have that kind of woo to the females, but in fact are wider face, strong, little bulldog looking, that sort of folks. It will turn out that the latter actually out-reproduce the former by a considerable margin when it comes to actually having more children. So I don't know and whether we know what this means about sexual access to females, but it is, in fact, interesting because there could be more involved here, that they're more dominant personalities and therefore perhaps they are more successful financially just from sheer grit and push. Maybe they're more dominant in bed, so they're more less likely to wear a condom because they don't want to. In other words, who knows what is responsible for that sort of data? But it's interesting that data, you know, at least was in play 20 years ago when this question was being considered by academic, you know, evolutionary psychologists. What we now know about this, I don't know. So this is a long, mealy-mouthed answer to say that, first of all, there isn't such thing as an alpha male. There is dominance, hierarchy, ascension, motivation to get more resources, but this isn't through exactly a vertical situation. It's far more of a scramble competition for more diffusely located status. And the both physical attractiveness as well as this sort of ascension are both useful in increasing your access to mates, but I think that it's a little bit impossible to tell us which is more important, except you could somehow, somebody could, if they wanted to, calibrate this and get it on using standard deviation units, which would be an interesting doctoral dissertation for somebody, that you could say, well, let's go up 10 percentile in looks and let's go up 10 percentile in this sort of ascending dominance characteristics and let's see what happens to, for example, some measurement like what we would call extra pair copulation. In other words, if you've already got a girlfriend, are you screwing anybody else on the side in addition? And we could look at this decile by decile on each of these two variables and see which variable predicts better that likelihood. That is how we would solve this question or shed some light on it empirically. I don't know that at this moment we have the answer. We do have some vestiges, as I'm recalling now, that the upper body strength of a male is predictive of upper extra pair copulations. So that's telling us that perhaps more than facial handsomeness, that could be, I don't know. I think that you have to separate these things out, organize them by deciles, and then use them as independent predictors on a dependent variable of interest, like in this case might be extra pair copulations or just sheer number of sexual partners, et cetera. So there's a lot of lot to be ground through there, and the answer is obviously both characteristics are speaking volumes to the female brain, or else males would not be extremely interested and worried about both, which they are. All right.
Fantastic.
Enough of that.
Yeah. Well, and the very next question is on the same topic, but it's from the female's perspective.
Okay.
So a few shows ago, you spoke about the fact that alpha males are wired to be unfaithful, and that's just how it is. So, dear Dr. Lyle, do you have advice for the female partner of such a male? How can a woman protect her interests in this situation? And what kind of expectations would be reasonable in this kind of relationship? As a woman, I'm not interested in casual mating, so I don't think I myself would be unfaithful, although I think I'd be okay with my partner having physical flings on the side. My biggest fear would be that he would fall in love and have an emotional affair. I would like some certainty from him that he would not leave me for a fling, although I know that's not a promise no one can make, that anyone can make in advance. How can the rules of this sort of relationship be negotiated in a healthy way? And what lines could or should be set in stone with a mutual agreement that if they are crossed, the relationship ends?
Very great question. I'm not sure. So, you know, this is now that I've got a few people listening to me and then feeding back stuff like, well, when you said this and when you said that, it's like now I understand what, you know, some major celebrity feels like. It's like, wait a second, what did I say? You quote me out of context. This is how when you're moving quickly and trying to speak in. And to try to get points across, you can say things that, you know, can be parsed and then people can misinterpret. So remember the answer to the last question, no alpha males in humanity. What we're talking about is highly attractive males and they're not wired to be unfaithful. They are. It's just that depending upon their individual nature, so males differ considerably in how pair-bond-oriented versus casual mating strategy-oriented they are. Now, some of this has to do with circumstances. In other words, what kind of body do you find yourself in? Do you find yourself in an extremely attractive body where you could take advantage of casual mating? Well, in that case, very often the individual will. And it could be that if you find yourself in a less attractive body, then the system basically is discouraging of that. And so it could be a flexible cost-benefit analysis that's being run. However, that's not all there is to it. There's literally individual variation in personality that's involved. So there are people that are extremely attractive males and could essentially, you know, deflower every virgin in the territory, but won't, because they're monogamous pair bonders. And so this has to do with apparently how much vasopressin the male seems to have just by nature of genetic variation. And so if you have a high vasopressin male, evidently these guys are very pair bond oriented. And if you have a low vasopressin male, then you've got a Mr. Philanderer. So this is this appears to be, you know, possibly a single variable that dominates at least the sheer genetics side of the issue, as opposed to the opportunity side, which is, you know, part of the cost-benefit analysis that the program is undoubtedly designed to run. But we are clearly aware, and there's more to it than that still. So every individual's circumstance is different. So, for example, you could have a male who's pretty pair bond oriented, but he happens to be in a pair bond that isn't the greatest deal for him, but it's a pretty good deal. And he happens to be very attractive, so he has a lot of potential mating opportunities with people that he would find superior to his existing mate. But he's got some oxytocin, vasopressin, pair bonding psychology, so he's a little bit difficult to lure, even with a lot of opportunity. If you start changing around some of these parameters, suddenly you can have wildly different outcomes. So let's suppose that we have a very attractive male whose mate he considers even more attractive than himself and feels like he got a hell of a deal. He still could find an awful lot of very interesting deals very easily, but they aren't as fancy as his mate. And so he is actually in a different position as far as that goes. And that's without even talking about the individual variation that's involved. So this person strikes me as they are asking, they're sort of looking at this question, and they've got a sense that their male may not be some hardcore, relatively rare monogamous pair bonder. So it sounds like he might have some sort of typical male chips that put him in the middle of the bell curve. And if he's highly attractive, then he's got a lot of options for casual mating, and she knows it. And apparently she doesn't get the sense from him or from the world or from her own assessment that she is fancier than he is. So she feels relatively over-rewarded. And so it looks like she's also has some other characteristics. If you're relatively over-rewarded, depending upon your personality, your negotiating tactic could go one of two ways. You could either become essentially obsessive and controlling and threatening and edgy, and therefore essentially terrorize any other females that come anywhere near this guy, and let him know that you're on red alert. That's one way. That would be a more emotionally unstable and more disagreeable personality, and not very open. That would be, which incidentally wouldn't be an unusual tactic for a lot of females to do. That's a perfectly reasonable tactic. I'm reminded of a study that was done with some kind of a bird, where what the investigators did was there was loose females out in the trees and the somewhere, and there was nests being built by the pair bonded females with their mates. And what the investigators did was that they moved the nests towards where the single females were, and the single females started visiting, and the pair bonded females raised hell and would essentially intimidate physically any single females that would come anywhere near their mates. That's, of course, what it is that we might see in a given situation. The situation that this person is describing is that they are taking a different tactic. And that tactic is, essentially, if I make life as good as I can possibly make it for this guy, he may not choose to leave me. And that's a very gutsy, a very open and agreeable and requiring a lot of emotional stability to pull off that tactic. That's a rare female that would sort of take a deep breath and not be looking for any quid pro quo in terms of her own adventurousness. Simply, she doesn't have it. She's basically saying, listen, I know men, I know this guy, and I know what this guy has available to him, and I have enough empathy for his circumstances and to understand the differences between myself and his psychology that I would be willing to let him live the life that his ancestors lived, which was what I call wife chippy. And that is that the difference in within species, you can tell how much of philandering was being done or how promiscuous a species is, primate, by looking at the size of the testicles relative to the body weight of the male. And so we can tell that our species looked about like that, like the male might have been largely in a pair bond, but everybody on this earth is a descendant of a long line of males who got a little bit more than their share, obviously. And the males that got a little bit less than their share, their genes aren't on the planet anymore. So she's recognizing the wife, chippy psychology that probably resides inside of her mate, and is trying to figure out what's in her personal best interest. Can she maneuver this thing and essentially beat her genes that would normally be telling her, mate guard, make it difficult, and don't let any of the other females get near him without getting a couple of teeth knocked out. Now, what would I say about this? What I would say about this would be that that probably the only reasonable solution is to talk through what you think that you could stand. And the notion here is for the person who is doing the accommodating, in this case it's her, it would be to have a discussion and say, listen, this is what I feel. I feel like this is how our lives could be. I mean, I could play the standard female tactic and sit here and cross my fingers and hope and be naive and hope that your own guilt over the fact that I might flip out and divorce you or something else if I find out about an infidelity, that we can play it that way. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to play this more openly, and I'm going to be more courageous about this, and I want to have a discussion about this, and I want to kind of hear where you're at and what you would like, and I want to imagine what it is that I think that I could live with and be reasonably comfortable. Okay? Now, those people might come to a decision about what they think an idea is, hall paths kind of concept. And this is, and there could be rules. And so she's talking about rules. There's a lot of rules that go on in this game, like you can only see a person three times. You know, that's it. Sleep with them three times and we're done. The something of that nature, something like, you know, one fling a year, something like this. So you could talk through ideas. And then, and one would hope that you could give your mate enough rope that they would feel satisfied with that amount of rope, and that they would not feel like they were chomping in the bit and that they wanted another, you know, 6 inches of rope. And the idea would be, we're not sure what I can tolerate, but this is what I suspect that I may be able to tolerate. And if that seems to work for you and it seems to work for us, then it's something that we can do. But this is this is an important principle in negotiating conflicts of interest in relationships that I'm about to describe. And that's that any accommodations that we think that we are willing to make, we have to understand and agree that these are experiments, that they are not negotiations, that we are not setting the rules. We are setting what we hope to be the rules. Okay? We're out to discover what it is that we can tolerate. We may find out that we thought that we were willing to do X, and it turns out that our partner goes ahead and does X, and then when that happens, we frickin' flip out. And it's a five-alarm fire. And we have to say, wait a second, I thought it was okay with me, but it's not. We don't want to be in this position where the partner is like, what are y'all upset with me about? I thought we had a deal. Okay? So we don't have a deal. We have a tentative exploratory experiment is what we have. And that's how we do things in this arena. And what we can hope is that a person like this with this kind of guts and this kind of courage and this kind of openness in this kind of a situation may be able to find that she remains and becomes so valuable to that male that that male gets the best of both worlds, neither perfect. In other words, we thread the needle of the conflicts of interest between two people, and we wind up essentially with a situation where she increases her value as a pair bond mate and makes him absolutely determined to defend that mate's feelings with as he essentially, you know, very carefully tries to satisfy any potent needs that he may have for casual mating on the side. So this is how we do things. We are open, we are courageous, we keep the communication up, and we try to be as honest and as dignified as we possibly can in these situations and as sensitive as we can. And when we wind up accidentally either breaking a rule and hurting somebody or breaking a tentative agreement, or the agreement itself turns out to be not good enough, then we have to sit back at the table and say, take a deep breath and realize what we're trying to do here is we're trying to do something difficult, and we may make mistakes, but we have to course correct if we're going to protect something as valuable as an outstanding pair bond. So this is dangerous territory, and the females in the world are all different in different circumstances with respect to this. So that's why experimentation and open and non-accusatory renegotiation needs to be the order of the day.
Amazing. And all right. Well, we've got caller on hold, and
very
we're going to take this caller. So, Don, welcome to the program. Where are you calling from?
From Las Vegas.
Very good. All right. How is it there?
How's
in
it going,
Vegas?
Guys?
Hey, Don, thanks for calling in.
Well, fantastic.
Very good. Well, Tell us a story. What's happening? What are you working on? And what are we trying to learn or get better?
Okay, well, I want to talk about my family and my relation to them.
Okay.
I feel like myself and my wife, we've become a little bit isolated,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. Most of them live in California. We're out in Las Vegas
mm-hmm.
Now for the last 6 years or so. But due to a major health scare a couple of years ago, we ended up switching over to a whole food plant-based diet, and it
mm-hmm.
Really helped us out.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of changed our lives, and we lost a lot of weight. And,
yeah.
You know, I had high cholesterol. She had high blood pressure. That all healed. So
mm-hmm.
It worked out well for us.
Mm-hmm.
We went to a family function, and everyone's saying, "Wow, you guys look great." They couldn't believe it. And some people even kind of standing next to them, they didn't even recognize me. But,
yeah.
But there were some who, for instance, my little sister, and I'm the fifth of seven. Okay, and I'm 57 years old, so I'm the fifth
mm-hmm.
of seven.
Mm-hmm.
My younger sister, a few of them are, you know, morbidly obese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she would walk past me and make a face and say, "You're too skinny. I don't like it." You know,
mm-hmm.
kind of like that. "You look sick," she would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's weird. Like you know, you can't say to somebody, you know, you're too fat. You look sick. But you can
yeah.
say that to somebody who lost weight, right?
Right.
Anyway, so I just kind of ignore all that. Anyway, later on, my mother and father, who recently they celebrated a 60th wedding anniversary a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom had a major heart attack about 5 years ago, and she was in ICU for 46 days.
Yeah.
So she came really close to dying, but she pulled through. But
mm-hmm.
we had to talk to them. We invited them out, and we had them out for a couple months, and we cooked for them all the meals, and then taught them how to cook, taught them how to shop, and then so they ate that way for a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom, who was on 8 medications, she
mm-hmm.
she got down to 1.5 medications. And then
mm-hmm.
my father, who was on 3 diabetes meds, he got off all his diabetes meds.
Mm-hmm.
This was all done under medical supervision, you know,
mm-hmm.
from their doctors.
Right.
So anyway, they feel great. They go back, and then, you know, they're getting compliments from everybody. My mom calls. She says she can't believe, you know, everybody just talks about how they're glowing. And I haven't seen her that happy in, you know, in 20 years. It was like she was 15, 20 years younger. She was. I haven't seen her that happy because she's, you know, somewhat disagreeable, I would say. And
yeah.
So anyway, some time goes by. We're very happy because when my mom showed up, she looked like she was 100 years old. And when she left, she was, you know, bouncing around. But
right.
when I talked to them after a few months, I guess they, I say, "Well, how are you eating?" And I say to my father, and he says, "Well, they, you know, the kids took us to a steak place, and, you know, we didn't want to be rude." So they sort of floated back into the way they ate before. Now,
right.
my father is a little bit more on board. He was still eating the oatmeal for breakfast and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So then I get on Facebook, which I, you know, post maybe twice a year or something.
Mm-hmm.
I basically just say happy birthday to somebody. But
yeah.
then I say, I tell them what happened. "Hey, we got, you know, got everybody off their meds, and, you know, here's how we feed them. If you guys want any information, call us. We'd appreciate it if you wouldn't feed them, you know, meat and dairy."
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, that caused a lot of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it really made me mad because, you know, I feel like almost out of spite to me, they're just feeding them steaks and, you know, bacon and eggs and sausage and, you know, whatever, butter and pancakes and syrup. You know, back to the old way, and then they get sick again. So we had them back
yeah.
out again for about not even 4 or 5 days. My mom shows up with a walking stick.
Mm-hmm.
She can barely step up from, you know, into the house, which is about a 4-inch step.
Yeah.
And she can barely stand. By the time she left, she had no pain, and she forgot her walking stick. She, you
mm-hmm.
know, so when we write, we say, "Hey, we did it again, you know. If you
mm-hmm.
guys can feed them this way, we'd appreciate it." But I feel like everyone's kind of turned on us
mm-hmm.
and kind of had a run-in with my sister. They were going to have an 80th birthday party for my mom. Mm-hmm. And so they were asking for $300 for each one of us, supposedly for food. So mm-hmm. then I say, okay, I'll give you $200, and then I'll bring $100 worth of plant-based food,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that I'll have something to eat, and, you know, mom and dad mm-hmm. and whoever else can eat that food.
Right.
And then I got attacked, and they all started attacking me, saying that, you know, you're trying to push this on us, and why y'all should push this on us. I said, hey, you call me and ask me for money. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm not pushing it on you.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know. So that's kind of where I'm at. Then later there was another incident, had to do with Facebook, where somebody posted that someone was sick, and I didn't know who was sick, but I jumped on. It was somebody who I liked. It was my cousin's wife. So I write on there, and I say, hey, you know, good luck to them. And then I say, you know, hey, a lot of diseases come from foods, you know. Here's a good documentary to watch. And
yeah.
then so people start attacking me, other cousins, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of a little bit under the control of my sister, I would say.
Yeah.
And and then my one cousin is particularly attacking, and I say, why does it matter so much to you? And anyway, it's her mother. I said, oh, that's my aunt. My aunt has cancer. I didn't know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then so then we post, well, here's an article that says that the American Cancer Society recommends a plant-based diet for people on chemo and after chemo. It's it helps you have the fewest amount of problems with chemo. And anyway, I post that, and everybody just comes out of the woodwork and starts attacking us and saying that we're rude and that we blame people for getting cancer. And so that's where we're at now. And so I just, you know, don't go on Facebook anymore, obviously.
Yes.
And I don't go on anyway. I maybe post a couple times a year, and it's usually just something, you know, nice. But I don't know. There's like a whole group of my family now that's kind of turned on me. And I'm upset because, you know, we sort of proved, like, to my parents and,
mm-hmm.
and to everybody that, you know, if they want to be healthy, if they want to live longer,
mm-hmm.
then they can do this. They can choose
mm-hmm.
that. But, you know, they go to my sister's and brother's house, and they get fed these meals. And a lot of my sisters and brothers are very, very sick. I mean, they're very,
yeah.
a couple of my sisters had radical mastectomies and,
mm-hmm.
and they're morbidly obese, and it's just bad. And it's upsetting mm-hmm. to me that they don't want to put any kind of effort in.
Right. Oh, you mean for themselves or for your parents?
No, for my parents. If they don't want to,
right.
if they don't want to do it, that's fine. I don't,
right.
and I don't think that I push it on anybody. I don't think I do.
Yeah.
When I go to a family function, people, you know, kind of crowd around us and say, wow, what are you guys doing? So we give them a 10
right.
or 15 second explanation, then we change the subject.
Sure.
Now, I had a brother-in-law who came up to me and was asking me, he said, hey, I really want to do this. But I talked to him for a minute. I didn't think that, I thought he was just being polite. But then later he came up to me and said, listen, both of my brothers died of heart attacks. Both of my parents died of heart attacks. My other
mm-hmm.
brother is in the hospital. He's dying of something. He said, I have
mm-hmm.
two stents and I have diabetes. I'm going to die. I want your help. So then I
yeah.
said, oh, okay, you really do want my help.
Yes.
So then we stayed the night in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
went with them yesterday, bought them a kitchen full of food, bought them some, you know, pots and pans and cutting boards, which they don't have cutting boards, so I know they don't eat vegetables, and try to get them going on it. But I think he just kind of petered out. Like, he did it for a few days, and then he just quit. So, you know, but I don't think I push it on anybody, and I don't know what to do. I feel like when I think of my parents and I think of the way they eat, I know if I were to go and see my mom right now, she would be walking around like a 100-year-old woman.
Right.
And it just breaks my heart.
I hear you. And so, you know, Dawn, this is a tough landscape to navigate. There's so many, you know, there's so many things that I could say about this, and there's so many different things to consider. The there's people cannot help but get disturbed when we do things better than they do them, and those things that we do require conscientiousness. And so this, they cannot help but infer that we are displaying our superiority to them. And
I get that. I try not to do it, but
I understand
that.
I can hear in you, believe me, I've talked to, 10,000 vegans in my life, at least. And I probably had individual conversations with 5,000 vegans. And I have heard every kind of personality as they come about this problem and deal with it. And you are not a disagreeable person, and you are not emotionally unstable. You are not sanctimonious. You are honest and decent and helpful, and you are doing what any reasonable person would do that has a backbone and a brain when facing a situation like this. And unfortunately, there are character limitations in your siblings. And I can only imagine, what it would have been like. I don't know what Darwin's family was, but you knew this guy was sweating bullets for 25 or 30 years. I think he knew the truth about theory of evolution by about 1934, and he didn't publish until a gun got put to his head in 1859 or 1858, when Wallace came up with the same idea. So he didn't want to face it. He did not want to face this enormous, shitstorm that was going to hit him. He just didn't. It wasn't in him. But he was tough. He was a tough guy. He was strong and stable and decent, and a more decent human being probably never walked the earth than Darwin. And so in the same way, when we bring valuable new information that contradicts, cherished beliefs, we can expect that we're going to get trouble. And you did, and you were as gentle as you could be, but you got it anyway. Had fate been a little bit different and your sister not been a conniving and problematic political animal, then this thing could have been a really nice story. Okay? But had Hitler not been Hitler, we wouldn't have had the problems we had.
Right.
So personality matters in these things, and so we've got a mess. And one of the problems is obviously that because your parents live closer to them than they do to you, your parents, in their 80s, are facing the pleasure trap as neophytes. And neophytes don't do well with the pleasure trap. You have to be at least a journeyman, if not a master, to deal with the pleasure trap. The pleasure trap is no trivial problem. And so there's no way your parents are going to face the pleasure trap in the face of this kind of, political chaos. So now all I can say is they either come and visit you often or move nearby you, or pretty much what's going to happen is what's going to happen. Okay?
Yeah, we recently invited them out a few months ago, and we wanted to sort of repeat the same thing. And we said, hey, they live in the mountains. We said, hey, it's cold up there. Why don't you come out here and, we'll cook for you and everything.
Yeah.
But my mom had doctor's appointments. And what it seems like is her health has declined to the point where she can't travel out here now.
Right.
So it's almost like, to me, it was like, that was the last trip out here.
Yeah.
So
that's... This is one of these things where what's your dad's age?
82.
We have to look at it in the following way, and that is that these two people got the full ride.
Yep.
They really did. 80 years, if they're still ambulatory at age 80. They got the full ride. Now, you and I know that if they were to do something remarkable, if they were to actually completely turn their lives around here, they might have 10 more years on the table, 10
right.
more decent
but
years.
Healthy
it is
life.
Possible.
Healthy 10 years.
What's that?
A healthy 10 years.
Yeah, they might. Now, they might not.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
So they might only have 4 healthy years left. At this point, you know, you're so far out of warranty at age 80, particularly people that have lived conventionally. So we don't know what their future could be. That's very speculative. But what's much more likely to happen, we didn't get sort of a miracle. And the miracle would be that they had together both the personalities and the motivation to take this information and actually run with it. Let me back up and just give you a little bit of perspective on this so that you don't feel like this was such an obvious and blatant opportunity squandered, okay? And I don't know how much good this will do you, but I do want you to get a perspective on this. I work for 3 of the most prominent change agencies in health in the world, the McDougall Program, True North, and Engine 2. And
yeah,
so we get people that are incredibly motivated. They spend a lot of money and they travel a lot of miles. And I would say True North is the most extraordinary because they're going to come there and they're going to water fast. And they're going to get
right.
sick to their stomach and vomit and have trouble sleeping and all for what? Some theoretical improvement in their health? It's like, wow, this is a big deal. You know, McDougall is expensive. Engine 2 is expensive and you got to travel a long ways. These are major sacrifices. And many of the people that I see that come to all these places are not made of money. They're not like wealthy people doing it for a lark. They are middle class, hardworking, intelligent, highly conscientious people that want to get a hold of their health and they want to live. They want to live the rest of their life and live it to the fullest. And that means not to the most self-indulgent. And those people come and they listen and they learn and they try to adopt things. And I tell you what, they fight it, not from bad attitudes, but they fight it from the inherent problem of the pleasure trap. We are not designed to make the choices that you and your wife are routinely making in the face of alternative choices. We are designed by nature to eat the richest, gooeyest, most calorically dense, most convenient food that's in our environment. That is wired into the genetic code of all animals. And for us to consistently go against that is heroic. It is not easy and is not for the average human. And so it takes either unusual conscientiousness or unusual motivation, and often both, to actually fight this fight. So when you do it and you've done it and it seems relatively simple to you and you have heaped major rewards for it personally, it is very difficult from your perspective to look at this thing and say, well, for crying out loud, I would at least expect me to be able to have my mother do it. I don't love anybody more and there's nobody more worthy and I want to give it to her. And for crying out loud, if there's anything I could give back to the person who gave me birth, it would be the information to help her have her final days be way better. And you know what? Not very likely. Okay.
Yeah.
Even the people that make the trip all the way to our Meccas, what happens is that they struggle and they have to join Chef AJ's group and they struggle there and they fight it and they learn and they grow and they do successive approximations and they backslide. And there are successes, and there's quite a bit of people that have intermediate success. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying even among highly motivated people, it's difficult. Okay?
Yeah, I guess what I was hoping for was, you know, I don't know. I know that everybody's not going to change, but I thought out of a group of 50 people, I thought maybe one or two would, you know, take an interest. And
yeah.
And then someone else would have an ally.
Right.
You know, that's what I thought.
Yes.
If even just out of sheer vanity, because
yes.
they say, wow, you look great. You look 20 years younger. So even out of sheer vanity, I thought,
yes.
you know what I mean? So
because
people
I
are always talking
you.
About it, and they're joining Weight Watchers and Curves
mm-hmm.
and all these other nutty programs.
Sure.
You know, we did all those too. So I'll tell people, hey, we did all those dopey things. There was one called Sensa, where you
mm-hmm.
sprinkle this powder on your food, and it's supposed to make you not hungry. You know, we did all
sure.
those stupid things.
Of course.
And we said, hey, we tried every dumb thing. This is the only real thing to do. This is,
yeah.
and then we say we eat all we want, and the food is great. You know, like my parents tell them, we were never hungry, and the food's great, actually. You know, so I just thought that would be appealing enough that somebody would. It hasn't been that they're just kind of ignoring it. It's almost an outright anger. That
oh yeah.
I don't, that, and that's what I don't understand is the intensity
well,
of the anger.
Because you are signaling your superiority right in their face. Okay. Don't expect the unattractive girls to be happy when the attractive girl walks in and sits behind a desk 8 feet away from them. They're not happy about
right.
it. Okay? So this is esteem dynamic processes, and this is difficult on human beings. And like I said, your siblings did not happen to have a combination of unusually strong character traits that enabled them to embrace this and wish you well and learn. So there you have it. So you didn't get what you essentially deserved. You got what the world gave you. You had
right.
a marvelous flare of success with your parents. It sort of proved to you beyond any shadow of a doubt that it wasn't just
twice.
Lucky for you. Exactly. Okay. But, you know, I think that what you have to do is what all of us have done in this space, which is that we speak quietly and we speak humbly. And if people are persistent in wanting to know, then we share. And even then, we share carefully. And we
right.
don't really expect anybody to ever adopt this. And they probably won't. And in your lifetime, which is probably going to be long and rich and healthy, there may be 10. So you may ultimately wind up changing 10 lives and changing them much for the good with this information. So whatever else it is that you do with your life and all the help that you give people as a normal member of the economy, pulling your weight in the world, you will also touch some lives that will also touch some lives. And so you'll have an effect. But it wasn't where you might have most hoped, and it wasn't as easy. You know, it was much more difficult than you thought. And I'll close with this, that my very good friend since the time I was 8 years old is Dr. Alan Goldhammer, and my co-author of The Pleasure Trap. And The Pleasure
right.
Trap was really the story of just how extraordinarily difficult this problem is of trying to live healthfully in the modern world. And you know, 15 years later, when we talk to each other now, we say we underestimated it. Okay, it's actually harder than we thought. And so this is the takeaway from this. You aren't quite recognizing your unusual personality characteristics with you and your wife and your very healthy dynamic that enabled you both to embrace this and make huge gains from it. That is unusual. So
you know, I have to admit,
yeah,
I probably wouldn't be able to do it without my wife. You know,
right.
this well. And
yes.
I think from here on in, my strategy is going to be based on something that you said in an earlier podcast to kind of take the attitude of, yeah, you know, it seems to be working for me. I'm going to continue to do it. And yeah, you know, the people that recommend this, you know, they don't know. I don't know if they know everything. I don't know if they're right,
right.
but it's working for me now. So to
yes.
sort of undersell it a little bit. So
yes.
that's going to be my strategy from here on in.
Good. All right. Well, listen, Don, thank you very much for calling. Very good call. And I'm sure, you know, because I kind of live with one foot in that world, we probably have a lot of listeners that have faced things similar. And so I'm sure that this was valuable. And thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, guys.
You bet.
Don, thank you very much for the phone call. Dr. Lyle, have a good night. Thanks for listening.
Very good.
If you
thank
like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.